The following talk about global warming was recorded for the LA Sound Posse by Elise Davies. In November of 2004, she spoke with Professor John Hart in Berkeley, California.
My name is John Hart. I'm a professor of environmental science at UC Berkeley. I study global warming and how climate change will affect ecosystems. My research over the last 20 years has taken me from the Tibetan Plateau to the Colorado Rockies to the Sierra Nevada, California.
So why don't you tell us what global warming is?
Global warming is a problem caused by gases like carbon dioxide, which are produced from the burning of coal and oil and natural gas. These gases act like a blanket in the atmosphere. So the problem of global warming is the problem of polluting the atmosphere with gases that form a blanket that trap heat into the Earth's surface. These gases, the most important that we are concerned about is carbon dioxide. Another one is methane. The way they act like a blanket is as follows. They're transparent to sunlight. So sunlight comes down through the atmosphere, goes right through these gases, hits the Earth's surface, and some of the sunlight, in fact, the larger portion of it, is absorbed and converted into heat energy instead of light. So we get light coming in from the sun, but when the sunlight hits the Earth's surface, it produces heat. Now, that heat would get radiated back out to space were it not for the greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide. Those gases absorb some of that heat and radiate it right back down to the surface. So it's not exactly like a blanket, but effectively it's like a blanket. It's trapping heat at the Earth's surface and causing the Earth's surface to get warmer. That's the greenhouse effect. And we have created more greenhouse effect because of our fossil fuel burning. There's a natural greenhouse effect. Way before the Industrial Revolution, there was carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases as well. But we've increased the amount by burning coal and oil and natural gas. So we've thickened the blanket. We've created a warmer Earth by trapping more heat due to the pollution of our atmosphere with carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases.
Is any of this caused by natural causes, or is it only carbon dioxide produced by human beings?
Well, first of all, way before we were burning fossil fuels, before we were producing carbon dioxide, there was carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and also other greenhouse gases, including water vapor, which is probably the single most important natural greenhouse gas. These gases have produced an Earth's climate which is very favorable for us. 200 years ago, if we looked in the atmosphere, we would have found about a little less than 300 parts per million of carbon dioxide. And that's there naturally. That's the what we call the background level. It's produced by decaying organic matter in the soil, but it's consumed by trees as they photosynthesize. They take up carbon dioxide. And the balance of carbon dioxide is what we call the natural background. And it's about 30-40% less than the background, than the levels today. Now, if it weren't for background carbon dioxide, our planet would be way too cold to sustain life. It would be about 50 degrees Fahrenheit colder than it is today, way below freezing. So we're very lucky we have a greenhouse effect, the natural background greenhouse effect. It sustains life. But as with many things, too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. And our concern is the fact that we're now overloading the atmosphere with these greenhouse gases and producing a climate that's going to be hotter than it's been at any time in the last 1 million years, and possibly by the end of this century, an Earth climate that will be warmer than it's been at any time in the last 65 million years since the age of the dinosaurs.
Wow. How do you know what it used to be like? Somebody's been obviously keeping track of this.
Remarkably, there's a way to reconstruct not just what the levels of carbon dioxide were like 1,000 years ago, 10,000, 100,000, 500,000 years ago, but also what Earth's temperature looked like. And the way we do it is with ice cores. People have drilled deep ice cores, almost a mile and a half deep, down into the Antarctic ice shelf, extracted these ice cores, brought them back to the laboratory, frozen, and measured the gas content of trapped bubbles of air in that ice. Now, as you go deeper into the ice, you're going back in time. It's like a time machine. So at the surface of the Antarctic ice shelf, you're seeing the ice that formed from last winter's, their winter or summer, their last winter's snowfall. But if you go back down deep into the ice, many hundreds of feet and even a mile, you can see back in time, back 600,000 or 700,000 years ago. And what you discover when you do that is that over the last 500,000 years, there have been a series of episodes in which the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere were very low, and then times when the levels were high. Not as high as they are today. We've pushed the level up above any level in the last million years. But they go back to levels that were much lower than they are today, and only a little lower than they are today. And the levels seem to oscillate back and forth between low and high. It's not a smooth oscillation. Right. It's a bumpy oscillation. Now, along with that, we can reconstruct what Earth's temperature looked like during that period. And the temperature of the planet also oscillated. It went in and out of cold periods, which we call the ice ages, and relatively warmer periods, which are the interglacials between the ice ages.
Right.
And the periods of extreme cold correspond beautifully with the periods of very low carbon dioxide. And the interglacials, when it's warm, are the times when the carbon dioxide levels are high. So there's a coupling between the temperature and the carbon dioxide. And what we now understand to be true is that it's a two-way interaction. The higher carbon dioxide levels cause the warming to occur as we come out of ice ages into these interglacials. But at the same time, where did the carbon dioxide come from? It came from the warming. So the warming produces carbon dioxide, and the carbon dioxide produces warming. And we call that a feedback effect, because A causes B and B causes A, and it's positive feedback because the effect of the warming on carbon dioxide is to make more warming. So it's reinforcement or positive feedback, not positive in the sense that it's necessarily good, but positive in the sense that it's reinforcing. So this is what the climate history tells us, that there have been episodes of cold, episodes of warmth, episodes of low carbon dioxide, episodes of high, and that they're strongly related to each other in a feedback relationship. The other thing that those data tell us is that while these temperature variations between cold and warm are huge, today we're pushing the warm climate even warmer than it's been during all of that 500,000 year period of glaciers and interglaciers. So we're doing something extraordinarily big to the climate. We're pushing it into a climate state that the world hasn't seen in 500,000 years. And for scientists, that's a very scary thing, to be producing a climate that's not one that has been experienced in all of the history of Homo sapiens. And again, we may be producing a climate that will be hotter than it's been at any time since the age of the dinosaurs, more than 65 million years ago. So we're doing something extraordinary to the climate, way beyond these natural variations. We're pushing the climate hotter than nature has produced a warm climate in the last 65 million years.
Based on all of these studies that you do, what can you tell us about what the future might look like? How hot will it get?
I should preface my answer by saying, what I've just told you is not studies that I personally have been engaged in. I've never drilled an ice core out of the Antarctic.
No,
I'm relying here on the published scientific research of literally thousands of scientists around the world and over the last several decades. So this is a huge undertaking by a whole community of scientists, climate modelers, glaciologists, geophysicists, people who study the climate and whose life work has been to understand this phenomenon. What's in store for the future? It's a very good question. First of all, to answer that, we have to rely on mathematical models. And these are called general circulation models. They're models that attempt to predict what future climate will look like. Now, they're different from weather prediction models. Weather prediction models are designed to tell you what the weather is going to be in your town in the next few days, maybe as much as a week in advance. Those are models that are telling you if it's going to rain on Tuesday or Wednesday, and are we going to get a freeze Thursday night. Very different phenomenon from predicting climate. Climate is the average of weather, average over fairly big areas of space and over time. So climate models can't possibly predict whether it's going to rain on Wednesday, November 4th, the year 2016. That's impossible. What they can do is tell us whether the decade of the third decade of this century is going to be, on average, 5 degrees hotter than the current decade, only 2 degrees hotter, or what? They're going to tell us whether it's going to be wetter or drier. And they're not going to tell us this about a particular town or location. They're going to tell us this about average temperatures over areas as big as perhaps the state of Massachusetts or half the state of Nevada. So this is the scale on which climate models operate, longer time periods and bigger spatial averages. And what the models tell us is that if we continue burning fossil fuels and producing carbon dioxide at the continuing rate that we've been doing for the last few decades, then by somewhere around the middle or end of this century, in Fahrenheit units, the temperature is going to be somewhere between 3 and 9 degrees hotter than it is at present. This is globally averaged. Now, you might ask, what's the big deal about, let's say, a 6 or 7 degree Fahrenheit temperature increase? Why should anyone worry about 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit? If you went out the door today and it was 6 degrees hotter than yesterday, you might not even notice it. It certainly wouldn't seem like a catastrophe. But let me remind you that the temperature difference between the depths of the last ice age and the present is only around 10 or 12 degrees Fahrenheit. So 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit is a big deal. It's about half as much as the warming that occurred from the last ice age to the present. And the point is that while 6 or 7 degrees doesn't seem like much on a day-to-day basis, when that's the yearly average, year after year, when it's that much warmer for long periods of time, it corresponds to a completely different climate for the planet, as different as an ice age climate from an interglacial.
Wow. Do you have any idea how hot it could get?
Well, I gave you sort of an average estimate, what we call the mid-range temperature warming. 50 years from now, let's say 6-7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer. Mm-hmm. Could be as much as 9 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer by the year 2050. And there's a possibility of some kind of unpredictable runaway effect, ocean circulation changes, or some other big dramatic surprise occurs, and it's even warmer still. But most of us who have looked at this think that if those surprises happen, they're likely to be not in the next 30 or 40 years, but perhaps in the next 100. In the next 30 or 40 years, if we don't take action to control production of carbon dioxide, that is, if we don't change our habits with respect to energy production, then it will probably be around somewhere between 3 and 8 or 9 degrees Fahrenheit hotter by around the year 2050. And this is going to have huge effects on our lives. It's going to be a major change in our climate, our environment, our ability to produce food, our health, our well-being, and even whether or not the place we live in is submerged under rising sea level or not.
I listened to a talk by Lester Brown in which he talked about the big crisis when it hits is going to surround our water supply and our food supply. And he spoke a little bit about how a simple thing like how much the difference in temperatures at night affects grain crops. And that simply by the fact that the temperatures now are slightly warmer at night than they used to be, it affects how much you get, because I guess at night the grain needs it to be cooler.
Yep. In fact, there are a couple of other effects as well. Right now, diseases are not as big a problem as they might be in certain parts of the country because of winter freezes, which the pathogens or the vectors that carry the disease can't tolerate. But if you warm up nighttime temperatures so that we don't get freezing temperatures, then the vectors, the insects that carry pathogens for certain diseases, like the mosquito that carries the malaria pathogen, will become more prevalent, more abundant, because they won't be killed off by nighttime freezes. So human disease-carrying insects, these are all creatures which are going to have a field day if nighttime temperatures warm up sufficiently so that we don't get these frosts that prevent these creatures from thriving. That's a really serious problem. The other thing about nighttime temperatures that's interesting is that people have argued that, well, these models that predict the future, they're just models. Why should we believe them? And an interesting argument is based on some of the details of what these models predict. I mentioned that they predict that the average temperature of the Earth is going to be such and such amount hotter than it is presently. But they make many more predictions than that. They don't just predict the average temperature. They predict, for example, that the temperature is going to rise faster in the polar latitudes than in the temperate or equatorial latitudes. They predict temperature levels are going to go up faster at night than during the daytime, faster in winter than in summer. And these detailed predictions form a kind of fingerprint, a predicted fingerprint. And now we can actually look at the record of temperature warming over the last 100 years. And what we find is that the measured temperature rise in the high latitudes versus the low matches what the models predict. The data show us that the nighttime temperatures are warming faster than the daytime temperatures. The data show us that the winter temperatures are warming faster than the summer. The details are matching what the models project.
Yeah.
Now, there's further evidence, and that is that if we actually look over the last 100 years, the temperatures have risen about 1 degree Fahrenheit. If we compare that with what the models predict should have occurred over the last 100 years, very good agreement. The models capture the last 100 years of warming and convince all the scientists who have seriously looked at this that warming is therefore due to the increase in the greenhouse gases, the carbon dioxide particularly, and that it's not due to other causes. Skeptics of global warming have said, well, maybe this 100-year warming trend that we've just observed is the result of a warming sun. Maybe the sun is just getting a little brighter. Well, the problem with that is that if it were due to a warming sun, the sun getting brighter, then we would expect daytime temperatures to go up faster than nighttime. We would also expect the entire atmosphere to be warming up. But instead, what we observe is that the surface of the Earth and the lower atmosphere are warming rapidly, but the upper atmosphere is actually cooling. And that's exactly what's predicted from greenhouse gas explanation. So we feel like we've really pinned down the cause of the last 100 years of warming. It's largely, not entirely, but largely due to the buildup of carbon dioxide, other greenhouse gases from human activity. So a consensus of scientists, an overwhelming consensus, has now concluded that human activity has caused a major share of the last 100 years of warming. And if we continue burning fossil fuels like we've been doing, then the warming is going to accelerate. And by the middle or end of this century, we're going to see hugely higher temperatures on the Earth's surface. And we haven't talked yet about the consequences, but we should get into that as well.
Yeah. Before we do that, I just wanted to ask you, you said something about the upper atmosphere actually cooling. My question is that also due to what we're doing, and is that a bad thing?
It's definitely the result of increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. What we do,
so it probably is a bad thing.
So, well, no. I mean, it's caused by an activity that is doing harm to us, namely by warming the surface. But our lives are not terribly affected by the fact that the upper atmosphere is cooler. There's only one respect in which that actually could make a difference, and that is that it might exacerbate the problem of the ozone hole, the hole in the stratospheric ozone layer, which allows more ultraviolet radiation to come through. That problem of ozone depletion and ultraviolet radiation is a completely different problem from global warming, but the problems do intersect. They interact with each other in the sense that cooling the stratosphere can exacerbate the problem of the ozone hole. It creates more ice particles, which have an effect on the rate at which ozone is depleted.
Well, it seems like we've already answered the question about why we should believe these projections, and that is because some of the projections have already come true, right?
They've come true, and there's no phenomenon we've observed that contradicts what the models predict.
Okay.
So it's what we've observed is consistent with what the models predict, and we haven't seen anything that is ruled out by the models. So the climate models are consistent with the pattern over the last 100 years, and we have every reason to take them at least to be approximate predictors of the future. We could be in for surprises. Nobody can ever rule out a surprise by the definition of the word surprise. And it could be that the models are wildly underestimating the magnitude of future warming, or possibly they're overestimating it. But right now, they're our best guess as to what the future will look like. I've done some work looking at how they might be wrong. And if they were wrong, which direction would they be more likely to be wrong in? Would they be more likely to be underestimating or overestimating warming? And here's what we found. We looked at one particular kind of surprise that isn't captured in any way at all by today's models, and that's ecosystem responses. As the climate warms, we know that ecosystems will be affected. In places where there's now grassland prairie, we may get desert. In places where there's now rainforest, we may get a drier forest. We may see certain areas growing more profusely, perhaps up in the high Arctic, and we may find other areas where the growth is stunted by the warming. Now, if we look in detail at certain kinds of ecosystems, I've spent a lot of time looking at alpine and subalpine ecosystems, what we find is that the responses of local ecosystems, of the plants, the forests, the trees, the grasses, is often going to be such as to cause what we call the positive feedback. That is, the plants will respond in such a way as to cause further warming. And this is not included in our current climate projection models, but detailed ground-based ecological studies indicate that we're likely to see these positive feedbacks. They occur in two ways. One, through changing the carbon balance on the planet. ecosystems can release carbon to the atmosphere when they're warmed. And that carbon will be released in the form of carbon dioxide, which will add to the carbon dioxide that we produce from fossil fuel burning. So that's a positive feedback to global warming. The other way in which ecosystems have a huge effect on climate is by changing the amount of sunlight that's absorbed at the Earth's surface. If you fly over any part of the land surface of the Earth and look down to the ground, you'll see sections of ground that are bright colored and shiny. Sunlight bounces off them, and you'll see other areas that are darker. Wherever it's dark, sunlight is being absorbed and converted to heat. Where it's shiny, sunlight is reflected back to space, and it doesn't affect our climate. So if you darken the Earth's surface, you can increase the amount of warming, warm the planet by darkening the surface. So the question is, how will ecosystem responses to global warming affect the shininess or the darkness of the Earth's surface? And we can point to examples in both directions, situations where we might see warming causing a darker planet surface and places where it will cause a shinier planet surface. And up in the high mountains and in the Arctic, those are among the places where we expect the surface to darken as a result of ecological change. If boreal forests spread their range where they can grow northward with the melting of ice and snow and melting of permafrost, then we're likely to see a darkening of the planetary surface. It will darken for two reasons. One, because the ice melts and ice is shiny. But below that ice will be soil, which is kind of intermediate. But now if forests grow where that soil is, it's going to get very dark. And so we'll get a super feedback effect from both the melting of the ice and snow and then from the spread of the forests. And that will greatly increase the amount of warming above and beyond what our current models project, because our current models don't include these ecological feedbacks.
Wow.
Same thing can happen in the mountains. Not in the Arctic, but just in the Rocky Mountains or the Andes or the Alps or the Tibetan Plateau or the Sierra Nevada, we are likely to see the increasing dominance of darker plants higher up on the mountains as the climate warms, and that will again be a positive feedback. And so you have this solar reflection feedback, and then you also have the carbon feedback. And together, those two could add up to cause more of a feedback than the direct effect of the fossil fuels. In other words, we may be more than doubling the amount of warming that we can expect because of these ecological feedbacks. But we don't know enough about ecosystems around the world yet to be able to say that with confidence. So this is still in a very active area of research. Happens to be research that I'm very involved in.
Is there anything we can do to reverse this?
Well, before we get to that, there's a question that should be asked, which is,
okay,
why should we care about all this? So what? So it gets 6-7 degrees, degrees hotter. Okay, that's almost as big as the difference between the last ice age and the present, but heck, you know, it's not that we're going to get inundated under snow. We know that would be bad for everybody if we had a new ice age, but it's just going to get warmer. Why is that a problem? What will more warmth do? It will mean we won't need to heat our homes in winter. That's great. We'll save money. It'll mean that farmers can farm crops up in northern Canada. What's wrong with that? Siberia will be a pleasant, you know, vacation spa for the world. Why should we worry? Well, here's why we should worry. It's many reasons. One is that these warmer temperatures are going to raise sea levels around the world. The reason is that warmer temperatures melt ice and snow, and they also just swell the ocean. They cause seawater to expand because most materials expand when you heat them. And the rising sea level could be as much as a foot or two by the end of this century, possibly even 3, 4, or 5 feet by the end of the century. And if we continue over the next few hundred years, we're likely to melt enough Greenland ice and Antarctic ice to cause as much as 10 or 20 foot rise in sea level. Now, so what? What's the problem with that? Well, it means that many South Pacific island nations will be completely gone. These islands have very little topography, and a rise of sea level of 1 or 2 feet can mean half their land area is gone. A sea level rise of 3 or 4 feet would reduce the area of southern Florida by as much as 50%, because so much of southern Florida lies very close to sea level. Areas on Long Island and in New York State, a huge portion of the country of Bangladesh would be inundated by such rising seas. And that's a serious concern. There will be climate refugees, tens of millions of people without a place to live. And guess what? They're not just going to tread water for the next 100 years. They're going to find other places, namely where us folks live, well above sea level, to reside. And it's going to cause huge repercussions, as well as enormous financial damage, measured in the hundreds of billions of dollars minimum. So sea level rise, problem number one. Problem number two is that with hotter temperatures, we're going to find that our crops are more thirsty for water, but at the same time that they demand more water because of the higher temperatures, we're going to have less water supply. The reason is much of the world irrigates its crops from the waters that come from melting snowpack. In the Rockies, the Sierra, and throughout much of Europe, the ice and snow that form in the winter then melt in the spring and fill our reservoirs, which in turn then supply our farmlands with irrigation water in the spring and summer. And with global warming, we are already seeing a trend in which winter snowpacks are reduced and snow melts much earlier in the winter. Some of the precipitation that used to form as snow and sit there in the snowpack until April or May, when it would melt and be used by farmers, is now falling as rain in January or February, and it's flushed out of the system well before farmers can make use of it. So the dwindling of irrigation water for farm production, at the same time that crops are going to be demanding more water because of hotter temperatures, is going to have a huge impact on food production. And especially in areas where there isn't irrigation. Most farm crops around the world are grown without irrigation supply. They rely on natural precipitation for their water, and they're going to be severely stressed. And then those sites that use irrigation water are going to find that there's less irrigation water available. So food production is very difficult to predict, but we could be in for major shortfalls in food supply. Another kind of impact is what we call sudden or extreme events, which are unusually intense storms, floods, hurricanes, droughts, weather events that are not chronic problems, but episodic problems, and that can cause hundreds of billions of dollars of damage. It's too early to say whether the very heavy hurricane season we had this year is the result of global warming. It might be, but it also might just be part of the natural variability in hurricane intensity. But we can say that the future will bring more and more hurricane seasons like this last one we've just been through in late summer, fall of 2004, and that the future is going to look very stormy. We're going to see increasingly intense weather conditions that are unfavorable for us. Another kind of unusual event is intense forest fire. And as the climate warms and dries, what we have is a greater potential for conflagration, massive forest fires. And we have seen steady increase in forest fire intensity and frequency in the West, Western United States, And we're likely to see that throughout the entire country as global warming persists. That can be both bad for people, it's bad for wildlife, and it's also yet another positive feedback to climate change, because those forests hold a huge amount of carbon.
Right.
And when they burn, that forest carbon goes up into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and contributes to further warming and to more forest fires.
Oh, boy. Apocalyptic.
Now, there's some more effects that people are very concerned about. One of them has to do with disease, both human disease and crop disease, agricultural crop disease. The problem here is that as the climate warms, I mentioned this earlier, we see a reduced likelihood of nighttime frosts and cold winter temperatures. And it's those nighttime frosts and cold winter temperatures that protect us from many of our diseases, crop diseases, and the vectors that carry human pathogens like malaria. So we could be in for more episodes of serious crop damage and the spread of human diseases from the tropics to the subtropics and from the subtropics to the temperate.
Seems like we're already starting to see some of that, doesn't it, with West Nile virus and SARS. And
now there's one last impact that should be mentioned, and we sometimes give it the perhaps overly colorful name of killer heat waves, but intense heat waves is certainly accurate. If you look at the weather page of the newspaper at the temperatures, and look in August at temperatures or July or June in Tucson and Phoenix and Houston, and you'll see temperatures often going up to above 100, as much as 120 degrees in Phoenix on occasion. Now, part of these intense, large urban area temperature heat waves is due to what we call the urban heat island effect, but not all of it. And increasingly, even without an urban heat island effect, we're seeing an increase in summertime temperatures and episodes of intense warming. Right now, we might see a few days each year in a city like Tucson or Phoenix when the temperature is above 110. It's a rare event, but it happens, and it's extremely, not just unpleasant, but unhealthy for people living in these cities. And what we're likely to see over the next 50 to 100 years, if global warming continues, is a huge increase in the frequency of these intense heat waves. Maybe some projections indicate we might see as many as 30 or 40 days each summer when the temperature is up around 120 degrees in Phoenix. And that's going to severely impact that city. It's going to impact the health of people, the ability of Phoenix to maintain its green lawns and its swimming pools. It's going to increase the demand for air conditioning, the time in which air conditioners are on. And again, that's a positive feedback.
Yeah.
So, because those air conditioners consume electricity, which at least today means putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for most of our electricity. So those are the impacts. And everybody that I know that has looked at them seriously has concluded that the costs of these impacts hugely exceeds the cost of taking the measures necessary to prevent the problem.
Mm-hmm. Just the other day, I was listening to an interview in which they were discussing fundamentalist Christians who have this belief in the apocalypse, and the reason they support an Israeli state is because they believe the second coming of the Christ is going to come out of Israel and that sort of thing. It seems like there are more and more people who have this attitude of, well, this is all part of God's plan. And, you know, it's really almost seems hopeless to kind of counteract that attitude.
The only advice I could give to somebody who thinks that is look into the eyes of your children or your grandchildren and try to tell them this. See how far you get.
Right. So Some skeptics say that we have another ice age coming and that global warming might be a good way to counterbalance this possible ice age. What do you say about that?
Well, in one sense, they're correct. An ice age is coming, but the question really is, when are we likely to see the next ice age? Certainly not in the next 50, 100, 200, 300, 500 years. Perhaps several thousand years from now, we will start to descend into the next ice age. These ice ages do come periodically, and we began recovering from the last one around 15, 20,000 years ago. The next one is, if we can base these predictions on what we've already observed over the last million years, the next one is probably going to be starting to become apparent 3,000 or 4,000 years from now. The global warming problem from fossil fuel burning is not a problem of 2,000 or 3,000 year duration. It's a problem for the next 50 to 200 years. And the time scales are just completely different. The time scale for the next ice age is not the next few hundred years. Now, I would go further and say it would be very wise of us to leave fossil fuel in the ground, to leave the oil and the coal, because several thousand years from now, our great-great-great-grandchildren, with many greats thrown in there to get us 2,000 years in the future, are going to curse us if we didn't leave them with the fossil fuels so that they could extract them then and build up a greenhouse effect to protect them against this next ice age. But that's a problem for thousands of years on in the future, not a problem for today. We should not be burning that fossil fuel today when we're in a relatively warm period of Earth's climate history. We should be saving it for the future when people will really need it. And instead today, we should be using solar energy.
It seems to me if you've got an ice age, the whole place is covered with ice, right?
Not
will
the whole place.
Creating a greenhouse effect really help us?
Oh, yeah. I suspect it's entirely feasible to ward off an ice age with massive amounts of fossil fuel burning. That, not because from the heat of the fossil fuels, that's not going to ward off the ice age, the heat of the burning, but because of the carbon dioxide from the fossil fuel burning. That could easily be of sufficient magnitude to alter the entire climate history of the planet on the scale of ice ages. That should be feasible. But this is not the time to be doing it, because we're not in an ice age, and we're not about to become in an ice age. We're far, far from the next ice age. And what we want to do now, in a warm period that's getting even hotter, is just the opposite of burning fossil fuel. We want to leave that alone, not keep making the warming problem worse with more carbon dioxide production, but instead look for energy sources that don't produce greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide.
You know, it seems to me like way back in the 70s, people were really paying more attention to this sort of thing. And there seemed to be, as far as our government and political leaders are concerned, there seemed to be more concern and more attention paid and that sort of thing. And I'm just wondering if you have anything to say about that.
Well, I started working on some aspects of climate change, started writing about it, wrote a section of a book on it in the late 1960s. And through the 70s, I was giving talks and doing research. And what I found then was that people were in a receptive is sort of the wrong idea, because they didn't like the idea, but they took it very seriously. But at that time, we didn't have the evidence to say with the confidence we can say today, the warming is caused by people and that it's going to intensify to the point where it will have unacceptable consequences. Back then, for example, we didn't have this fingerprint argument that we could make that pinned down the greenhouse gases and the fossil fuel burning as the cause of the problem. Now we can pin that down. At that time, I would have to say it was more speculation that that was the cause. We were beginning to see this warming trend occur in the 70s very clearly. We could say with little doubt that this warming was beyond the background level of warming. But it wasn't until the late 80s and the 1990s that we started seeing year after year with hotter and hotter temperatures. I mean, at this point, we can say the last decade of the 20th century, the 1990s, has been the hottest decade in the last 1,000 years. But we couldn't say that about the decade of the 70s or even the 80s. It was only toward the very end of the 80s and then the 90s that the signal became indisputable. And now we can make the case with much more conviction that we're seeing global warming and this is how bad it's going to be in the future. And you know, here are these projections, and here's why we should believe these projections, because they're based on models that do a good job explaining the past. And that if anything, our models may be underestimating future warming. See, we couldn't say that in the 70s.
That makes my question even more poignant. Why do you suppose it is that we're not paying as much attention to
one
it
argument
as we used
is,
to?
One argument is that we were too successful in the 70s in raising the issue. And what we did is we aroused the opposition. We got a mobilization in place of the economic interest groups that don't want to do anything about this problem. There are very major industrial economic groups. For example, most of the oil producers and car manufacturers who resist every step of the way. They resist what we consider to be sensible actions that we could take to reduce this threat. And why? Because it would mean that it wouldn't be business as usual for them. And they would much rather continue doing what they're doing. It's profitable and they're good at it. So they would like to continue doing it. And we who believe that the world must take action to reduce global warming have argued that, look, the things that we could do to reduce this problem will also be economically lucrative. You can make a lot of money making and installing windmills or producing photovoltaic panels or making more efficient automobiles. The profit on an efficient automobile is just as big as the profit on an inefficient automobile. And if you don't do it, someone else will. And if you want to be an economic giant of the 21st century, it would make sense to start now trying to get into the market with better photovoltaic panels or better windmills or more efficient appliances, more efficient automobiles. And I can't understand why huge companies don't join in with us on this effort and start the innovation process and development process and start making and selling better automobiles, more efficient automobiles. In the long run, it will be cheaper for us because more efficient automobiles mean we'll spend less money on gasoline. It also means we'll spend less money fighting to maintain our oil supplies in unstable parts of the world. And it will also mean, besides reducing carbon dioxide emissions, we'll have less acid rain, we'll have less smog, we'll have fewer oil spills along our coastlines and the oceans so that we'll have healthier ecosystems. And all we'll have less strip mining of coal that does so much damage to the landscape, less deep mining of coal that does so much damage to the health of coal miners. And instead, we can be employing people making and installing, operating photovoltaic energy systems, wind systems, and developing ways of using biomass in an environmentally safe and effective way. So to me, the economics is all on the side of getting there early, taking action, and not waiting for the Chinese or the Japanese or the Southeast Asians to become the world leaders in environmentally safe technology. The U.S. should do it. We shouldn't drop the ball. And yet our major companies, the big car manufacturers and the major oil companies, are all sticking their head in the sand. And they're trying ineffectively to fight the science rather than joining in the engineering argument, joining with the engineers and the economists who have argued that the right thing to do would be to start changing the way we make energies, we supply energy, and the way we make automobiles.
Mm-hmm. We've kind of answered the question, what can we do about it? But I also wanted to know from you what you consider the worst or the largest contributor. Is there any single thing that is worse than any other thing that we do that causes this?
Well, let's start globally and then work our way down. We look at the planet as a whole, all the countries. The U.S. produces about one-fourth of all the carbon dioxide because we are overwhelmingly the largest fossil fuel-consuming nation on the planet. And if you take into account the fact that there are other nations like China and India with vastly more people, on a per capita basis, we use 10 or 15, 20 times more energy than the poorer countries per capita. But we use a quarter of the total world's fossil fuel, produce a quarter of the world's carbon dioxide. So we're contributing one-fourth of the whole climate problem. So if there's any one country that ought to be particularly concerned with cleaning up its act, it would be the United States. If you look within the United States at the different energy sectors of our economy, what are they? There's transportation, which is mostly automobiles, but not entirely. There's home heating and cooling. There's electricity generation. And there's industrial processing factories. And they're all roughly comparable. No one of them is more than 50% of the total.
Oh, okay.
So you really want to make progress in all four. But if I had to pick the one where we can make the most immediate gains as quickly as possible, and where we could just write laws and put in regulations that 5-10 years from now would be making a huge difference, it would be automobiles. That's where the opportunity exists to tighten the fuel efficiency standards and apply them to the SUVs. There's no reason why SUVs can't all be hybrid systems. The internal combustion engine was, you know, a wonderful technology, and it's now inappropriate. So what we need to do is tighten the fuel efficiency standards. And instead of the average non-SUV automobile getting 25, 26 miles per gallon, which is now the case, the average of all automobiles in the fleet, including SUVs, ought to be around 35 miles per gallon. We have the technology to do it. It's economically feasible. The car manufacturers keep insisting that they can't do it because the public doesn't want these cars. Well, the public didn't want Hummers 10 years ago. They only started wanting Hummers when General Motors began to sell Hummers. And the argument that they make based on what consumers want is pure hokum.
Are there things that you believe individuals can do to make a difference on this issue?
Absolutely. And again, you can see these things we can do in most sectors of the economy. In terms of how we behave at home, we can put on a wool shirt and keep the thermostat a little lower in winter. We often find ourselves in overly air-conditioned rooms, and especially in public spaces that don't need to be kept as cold as they are. And we could save huge amounts of money and energy and produce less CO2 by doing that. We should exercise common sense in our homes. Don't leave, you know, windows open at night when they don't need to be. We should be ensuring that our homes are well insulated, and there are companies now that can do a home audit of the efficiency of your house and recommend economically beneficial steps you can take to improve the efficiency of your home. You'll have to pay a little money, but you'll end up saving money in the long run. When we buy appliances like refrigerators, we should look for energy efficient appliances. Usually appliances now come with labels that tell you something about the efficiency. And we should pay attention to those because it makes good economic sense as well as good environmental sense. When we buy automobiles, we should take energy efficiency into account, and we should try to use our automobile less when we can do it, bicycle or walk. It seems kind of strange that we now will often take ourselves and 2 tons of steel 4 blocks to pick up a loaf of bread. That doesn't seem to me to make a lot of sense, but it is something which each individual has to just think about and adjust his or her lifestyle in a way that, you know, makes sense for that person. But if they take into account the environmental consequences of driving those 2 tons of steel a few blocks to get bread, I think they'll realize that it's not a wise choice. I think that on the political front, there's a lot that people can do, and the most important thing would be to listen carefully to what candidates for political office say about the environment. Are they in denial about the science, or do they recognize the science? Now, they may accept the science and come to a different economic conclusion than you do about what to do about the findings of the scientists, but at the very least, you want to elect people who pay attention to science, who understand it, and don't try to replace science with just purely personal belief. The last thing, I think we want to be very careful not to, in people's opposition to the consequences of global warming, they should not be undermining the process of science that informs us about global warming. In doing that, they do lasting damage to the institutions which over hundreds of years have replaced fanaticism and ideology with rationality and science.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.